Hi, everybody. I'm a Grateful Al Anon. My name is Carrie Kay.
Hi, Carrie.
Every time I stand up and do this, my heart feels like it's going to jump right out of my chest, you know, and I know that God is here. In a moment, that's going to slow down a little bit. I was speaking in North Carolina one time, and I said, my heart's going to just jump right out of my chest, and a lady in the front row says, wait, well, let's hope not, you know. I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to come and share my story. It's always an honor and a privilege to be asked to come and share my recovery in Al-Anon. It's a lot of work to put these together, so you guys have done a great job. Let's give them a hand. Welcome to the newcomers. I'm glad that you're here. They told me when I came here if I heard something that resonated with me to stick around, and welcome to your new life. So with that being said, I'll tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And my knees are going to stop knocking here in a minute. I don't know if you can hear it, but I have a little bit of a drawl. I was actually born on a 500-acre cotton and soybean farm near a little town called Sledge, Mississippi. And Sledge is the home of Charlie Pride. That's its claim to fame. It's a little dot on the map. Yeah, Charlie Pride. It's about 50 miles south of Memphis, Tennessee. Well, we lived about 8 miles outside this little town. And my grandmother ran a little country store. So we had a family farm, and my grandmother, I have to like paint a picture with words here. That's how Southerners do it. And sometimes we take a long time. Let's hope I don't take too much. So my grandmother was the matriarch of the family. We had a little country store she did, and she ran it. And my father was the youngest of three children, and the other two children moved away. And there was no active alcoholism in my family growing up, but there was alcoholism in my family. I didn't know what it was until I got here and caught it from you guys, you know, how that works, you know. You learn all about it once you get here. There was no active drinking in my household, but what I know is that my father never, it was like he never cut the emotional umbilical cord for my grandmother. And so it was always like him, everybody was seeking her attention and approval. I was seeking his attention and approval and my grandmother's attention and approval, because that's what we learned to do, because she ran everything. She was like God. And my mother was 16 years old when she married my dad, and I came along when she was 18. When I was 7 years old, they divorced, and I think that, you know, my mom, my dad, and my grandmother, there was one too many people in that marriage, and one of them had to go, you know. So, they divorced when I was seven, and what I remember is getting up and walking down the little hallway, and I found five little suits of clothes hanging on the closet door and a note from my mom saying, I'm gone, I love you. Well, at 7 years old, I don't have the ability to discern why she's left, and it's not about me. So there's this huge abandonment wound that I now have. My mom's gone, and it's my fault. And around that, I have vague memories around that. One's very distinct, but I remember one time too, my dad, I think it was prior to that, sitting us down, my brother and I have a younger brother, 2 years younger. And you know, it's amazing. The family disease of alcoholism to me is like, you can have like a bunch of people growing up in the same house and everybody has a different experience, because his experience is completely different than mine. My father set us down and asked who we wanted to live with, my mom or my dad. Well, I'm not a parent. Well, I might be. I'll tell you that later. But that's a whole other part of my story. But at that time, like, I don't think that a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old really should choose who they want to live with. You know, that was a lot of responsibility in that choice. Well, we had a lot of land, and everybody we knew was there, so we said we wanted to live with my dad. My mom goes away, live with her mom, who's a paranoid schizophrenic, and my mom didn't have a lot, she didn't have a lot materially. And for many years, I thought that my mom had left me. And later in my recovery, I learned, sometimes I jump around in my talk, I'm not doing this, this is coming, so however it comes, let's go. You know, I think that, like, I thought that my mom didn't love me, but what I realized after a lot of inventories and amends with my mom is my mom really made the ultimate sacrifice of love for me to leave me in a place where she knew that I could be provided for materially and have a lot better opportunities in life, that my dad could give that for me. And it was the ultimate love, I think, that she shown, and I didn't see it that way at all. The way I'm affected by the family disease of alcoholism is I have a distorted perspective, and you're going to hear a little bit more about that as we go here. So my dad remarried right away, because apparently that's what my family does. People can't be alone. And he married a gal who was from a city, and she couldn't make cornbread, and we didn't like her at all, you know. Well, what I didn't know, here again, a lot of what I learned is in hindsight. I did not know this until after her death, probably. She was raised in an alcoholic home. Her father was an alcoholic, and she was in charge of taking care of her siblings. And when he would come in at night drunk, if she hadn't done something right, he would beat her and put her in a closet. Well, I think that she was looking as my dad as like a savior, because she had a hole in her heart too, right? And my father, he didn't realize it, but he set me up to be pitted against her on the day that they married, because he said, "You'll never come before my children, ever." And for some reason, because of how she was wired, it was like on between me and her in competition for my dad's love. And so I also didn't know until she had passed away that she had had a daughter when she was young out of wedlock, that her family made her give it up for adoption. And I think she saw me as maybe being that daughter that she never had. And she wanted to dress me in like frilly little dresses and stuff. Well, I'm here to tell you, we're out in the middle of nowhere. It's like, it's pre-Beverly Hillbillies type, you know. Way beyond Dukes of Hazzard. We're out in the middle of nowhere. We don't have a phone for like 3 miles from where I live until I was 13 years old. They finally paved our road when I was like 11. I mean, really, we're out in the sticks, you know. They taught me to chew tobacco when I was, you know, 7 years old. I learned how to drive when I was 5. I could shoot. I got my first shotgun when I was 8. Who wanted lace? That did not work with the woods, you know. So I didn't want the things that she wanted, and we began to butt heads very quickly. I was supposed, Dad wanted a boy, and I was first born and wasn't, so he just thought he'd just raise me like one, which was good until later when I went a little farther with that, and he thought was good, you know. And he had some ideas about that too. But so shortly after they were married, she began to be emotionally abusive to me. And I wouldn't have used those words for it then, because Southern people discipline their children pretty strictly, you know. But then not too long, and it was in secret. She would tell me, you know, not to tell my dad. And then it got physical after a while. And she really instilled a lot of fear in me that if I told anyone, it would be worse. You know, it would be worse. And I have no reason to think that she wasn't telling me the truth. So I began to keep secrets, and I began to learn how to wear a mask and not show you what's really going on inside of me. And this is like training for Al-Anon. I'm telling you, I was cutting my teeth early. I didn't even know it. I don't think any of us do. Denial is very powerful. And so I began to learn how to not I disconnected from my feelings. I shut my feelings down, and I was always had a smile on my face because that was acceptable. Well, things rocked on. You know, I have a stepbrother. He's 2 years older than me, and you know, there's not a lot to do way out where we live growing up. You know, hunt, fish, work, drink, have sex. You know, I mean, there's just very limited things to do. We, you know, on our TVs, if you wanted to get that third station, you had to go out and turn the antenna, you know, I mean, really far out. So in my early teens, we went out in our family car. My stepbrother was driving, and we were out with some other kids that my father didn't really want us to associate with. And that night, I lost my virginity to one of the guys that I liked, and my dad didn't want me being around him. And on the way home, my stepbrother raped me. Well, again, I want to show you my distorted perception. I couldn't discern that what he had done was worse than what I had done earlier that evening. So I just, again, shut it down, pushed it away, and pretended like everything was okay. So how I dealt with that was, for the next probably year and a half, living under the same roof with my stepbrother, I would control and manipulate situations so that I didn't have to be around him alone ever, if that was possible. And I got very good at doing that. You know, I can tell you that I would lay awake. If I didn't go to sleep before my parents did at night, I would lay awake petrified with fear till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And that's really not a way for a child to grow up. It's just not. But that's how that was the situation that I was in, and I learned to cope with it, and I did the best I could with what I had. And these coping skills, you know, they ran out. They quit working on me at some point. But when I was 15 years old, we lived across the pea patch from my grandparents. And one morning, I was blow-drying my hair, and I heard the phone ring. We had a phone by then. And the phone rang, and something was wrong. We ran over to my grandparents' house, and my grandfather had fallen away from the breakfast table. And we didn't know it, but he had an aneurysm in his brain, and it burst. And I remember my dad was on the phone with my grandmother, and I remember them being there. And I turned my grandfather's head towards me, and he was the only one in our family that had blue eyes. And I watched the life leave him. And that was a very powerful, powerful experience for me. And immediately I began thinking how I could be there for my grandmother and my father, and I didn't cry. because I was supposed to be there for the family, because there was all these unwritten rules about what you're supposed to do. And it was probably a week or so after his funeral that I went back to the place that he and I used to squirrel hunt together. That was his thing that we did together. And I was set in the woods, and I could finally cry. You know, in program, when I got here, the whole God thing scared me to death, because I grew up in the Bible Belt with Southern Baptist, you know, hellfire and damnation, and I thought I was going to burn in hell forever because of how I was wired. And what I realize is, now looking back, sorry, I lost transmission there for a minute. What I realized looking back is that God was always there. I just didn't recognize how God was showing up. When I was like 14 or 15, I'd get out of school and go get my chores up very quickly because I did not want to stay in the house because she was in the house. So I'd get on my motorcycle, grab my shotgun, go down to the river, and I would squirrel hunt. And towards, you know, when it got almost too dark to hunt, I would sit on the edge of the riverbank with the cypress trees, and the ducks would be coming in. You know how the mallard ducks, when they do like that, they're coming in, and the catfish would come up from the bottom and pop the top of the water, and the ripples would go out, and the squirrels would be scampering back to get to their nest before it got dark, and the sun would be setting, and it was peaceful. And there was God. God was there, but I didn't know, just wrapping itself around me just so big to give me what I needed to get through. Well, when I was 12 years old, my father set me down and he said, "Carrie, there's three things that you can do that I will disown you for. Steal, love a black, or love a woman." And I have no earthly idea why he said this. I do now, but I didn't then. And it made no sense. But when I got ready to go to college, right before my senior year of high school, they picked the 200 smartest kids in the state of Mississippi, and they sent them to this charter thing that they were doing called Governor School. We went for 3 weeks, and we studied whatever interested us. They have several things to pick from, and we wrote a paper that we presented to the governor. And I got chosen to go do this, and it was at Mississippi University for Women. And I wound up going to school there. My father had told me that if I wanted to go to school, that I needed to get a scholarship because he couldn't afford to pay for me to go to school. We had land. We were land poor. We had status, but we didn't have a lot of money, you know. So again, here's my distorted perception. When it's time to go to college, I wanted a softball scholarship because I was a great softball player. I was like the golden child, right? Straight A's in school, was a great softball player. I could knock the head off a match with a rifle from 50 yards, you know. I mean, I could just do anything great because I was seeking acceptance and validation from the things that I did because I had this huge hole in me. Well, they didn't give very good softball scholarships, which was a very big disappointment to me, and I wound up resorting, because I had such a high ACT score, I was able to apply for what they called a Centennial Scholarship, and I had to resort for a full year, fully renewable academic scholarship that paid for everything, and I thought that was not as good as a softball scholarship would have been, you know? I'm telling you, us Al-Anons are not wired, right? I mean, we really have a distorted perception. So I wound up going to Mississippi University for Women, it's an all-women's school, but it went co-ed right the year that I got there. I was in school for like 2 months and found myself in a relationship with a woman. Now, I didn't know what was different about me, because I'm out there in the middle of nowhere, you know what I mean? It's like really like deliverance. I mean, you know. But I knew whatever it was wrong, you know, because I learned about that in college. And so, I mean, this is part of my story. I have to tell it. So I got in a relationship with a woman, and here's generally where I say I could save us a lot of time and tell you that I was basically in the same relationship for 10 years, but the faces just kept getting different. You know, there was like no time in between, and they were very similar, and I didn't learn much between one and another. I did what my family does, which is go from one to another. And it's interesting, you know, I think denial is a very powerful thing. And I think I was probably on my fourth or fifth inventory before I realized that my first partner may have had an issue with drugs and alcohol. You know, I got here because I began dating a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in my mind, that's where it started, you know, and it just never occurred to me that, like, you know, having broken up with my first partner and her coming in the middle of the night, our rooms were suited. We each had our own room, and it was joined by a bathroom. And I would hear the door open, and I would hear the door close, and I heard this big thud one night, and she fell on her face because she just passed out. She didn't make it to her room, but she just fell right on her face in her room. And I remember going in there thinking, wow, I probably should get back with her, because if we stay broken up and she keeps doing this, it's going to be really bad for her, you know. And that's not something that normal people do. They probably go, whoa, I need to get away from her, you know. Not me, man. I will fix you, okay? I will. Just give me a chance. I promise. Oh. got into my second relationship, and right before my senior year of college, my stepmother, my dad had moved to Dallas, Texas by this point because we'd had bad years of drought and flood, and he had started, he and her together had started driving truck for a living. And I called him one day, and I said, "How's it going?" And he goes, "Okay." And I knew that meant somebody was probably dying because that's how my family is. I wound up going out to Dallas, and I went to the doctor with my stepmother, and she had a tumor in her kidney. And as it turns out, she was eaten up with it throughout. They wouldn't even open her up to do, you know, to look. And so my dad was in between jobs, and he didn't have insurance at that moment, and so he took her home to my grandmother's to be nursed to death. Well, I lived about 2.5 hours away, so for like from the fall till the spring, every 2 weekends I would go up to my grandmother's to, I mean, this is a big deal. My grandmother's taking care of her and she's dying and my dad has to work and to be with her. And I watched this woman who was really bigger than life literally be eaten up by cancer. And what was interesting was when she got sick and I went to the hospital with her or to the doctor with her, it was as though she reverted to a child. And she wanted me by her side constantly. Well, I don't have any tools for dealing with all the resentment that's just seething. I'm this cauldron of resentment for this woman that has just abused me so badly. And she wants me to be right by her side all the time. And I didn't know how to deal with it. You know, so I just show up. I've always been taught to suit up and show up, even in the dysfunction that I grew up in. Southern people do the right thing, you know, except when they don't. So spring semester of my senior year, my mother's mother, the paranoid schizophrenic, I wasn't really close to her, but she died, and within like 3 days, my stepmother died. And I was getting ready to go to medical school. I was very bright, and I'm certain I would have become a doctor and been the best brain surgeon in the world, because that's the kind of Al-Anon I am, you know. I said when those two people died, something inside me just was like, you can't take the MCAT. Can't do it. That was God, but I didn't have a connection with it then, so I didn't know that. And so my partner that I was with at the time, she had a sister that lived in Southern California, and she was going to go stay with her sister and pursue an acting career. And I thought, hey, why don't I just go to L.A.? You know, why not? I got nothing better to do. That would be my first geographical, and I didn't know what that word was or what I was doing. My family thought I was crazy because I'd never been west of Dallas, Texas. And it's big out in Southern California, you know. I'm driving in my little brown Pinto all packed up. You know, I think every lesbian in the world had a little brown Pinto, right? But we're driving across the United States. And in Mississippi, there's one interstate that goes from the north to the south to the Gulf. Two lanes each side. When you come into San Bernardino, it's like 10 lanes on your side, you know. I mean, I'm like, oh, my God, I'm scared to death. Well, I figured I could always go home. You know, so I'm sitting in my friend's sister's house in El Monte, California, which is not really a place you want to be. And I was like, what have I done? Well, got a job. And I went, I mean, within like a month, I found somebody else that I was attracted to and came home and told my partner, I don't want to be with you anymore. I want to go see somebody else because I have morals, you see. I won't be unfaithful, but I'll come home and essentially kick you out, you know. So I got in another relationship and then another one. Okay, when I was growing up in Mississippi in college down there, we had to drive 2.5 hours to a gay bar in Alabama. And you know, in Southern California, they have bars on every corner. They have a newspaper. They have like a gay town. I mean, it's okay out there. And I was like, oh my God, a kid in a candy store. And you know what they have in bars? Alcoholics are in bars. I don't know if y'all know this, but they are. And I have a gift. I don't know if any other Al-Anon here has it. I'm like a heat-seeking missile. If you put me in a room with 500 one alcoholic, if there's 500 people, there is one alcoholic, I will find you in 3.2 seconds. It's a gift that I have. I don't, you know, I'm finally okay with it. For years, I thought it was a curse. But so I was in a relationship. This is like my fourth one since I was in relationships. And she drank a lot, which really didn't bother me because that was kind of predictable, but she did cocaine, and that made things very unpredictable. And so I got pretty tired of that behavior because she had a young baby that I would wind up being, you know, keeping. And they don't come home when they say they're going to come home when they go out on binges like this. So I told her one day in big dramatic fashion, it's so funny, as an Al-Anon, I'm the kind of person, not anymore, but when I got here, like, I didn't want any attention on me because attention had always been negative and bad things had happened when I got attention. And so I wanted to be with the lampshade alcoholics and just stand, like, kind of behind the curtains pulling the strings, you know? Well, like, they're the dramatic ones. No, we are too. Let's get honest about it. You know, we're dramatic just in our own way. So I flung the shower curtain open while she's, you know, I told her I didn't want her to do any more cocaine, and then I found some a week later because, duh, guess what, you know? Like, telling her to stop was going to do anything. I didn't know the first thing about addiction or alcoholism or any of that. And so I left. As a result of me leaving that relationship, I then... And there's some sick Al-Anons in the room who are going to get this. I then went about trying to find out all the lies that she certainly told me while we were together. And I saw an ex of hers who was with this woman who was 2 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that girl that was sober, they told me she didn't drink anymore. And I thought she was rather a biatch, okay? Let's, you know the word. I mean, I just thought she was sullen and moody and just... And now, it makes perfect sense to me now that the next time I came in that woman's presence, I fell head over heels in love with her. We went on a date, and now I've hooked my wagon to hers, and we're together. And that happened like in 3.2 seconds. And so they told me that she didn't drink, and I'm smart. I know that my problem is from people drinking and using drugs. So now you've told me someone I like doesn't use drugs, and so I think, or doesn't drink, pardon me, that my problem is solved. You know something else we learn here? Drinking is but a symptom of alcoholism, okay? Just a symptom. There can still be a lot of insanity. So I went to a lot of late night AA meetings with her because she went to late night AA meetings down at in Silver Lake at the Alano Club over there. And I had never been around anything related to program at all. AA, AAA, I don't know. I'm in California. I'm completely overwhelmed with everything, you know? I mean, like, I remember within the first month of moving there, I was going crossing La Brea to get out to a freeway, and I'm people made fun of me because I spoke in colloquialisms and they couldn't understand what I was saying. I was such a hick. It hurt my feelings so bad, you know? I mean, like, they were not nice. I mean, Southern people are, you know, we're nice, and they weren't nice. And so I was sitting in the morning at 7 a.m. at this crosswalk waiting in traffic, and a girl walks across the crosswalk, and she's got on a black leather jacket and combat boots and piercings in every orifice in her face and a purple mohawk, and I was like, oh, my God, what have I done? I don't even know that that's a human being right there. It's like an alien. You know, oh, thank you, God. God had to take me clear across the country to get me far enough away from the, you know, from the dysfunction that I could get some recovery. So I'm going to AA meetings with my partner, and I think that these steps are great for her because I don't have a problem. I do have a problem, and you're hearing about it, but you're going to hear more about it. But I have like the good guy syndrome. I want to ride up on my white stallion and take care of everything. And here's how sick I'm going to give you just a little bit of a glimpse of it in case you won't know. We were dating about 3 weeks, and I opened the glove box in her car, and there were like 101 parking tickets because she lived in Pasadena and didn't have the decals for the right side of the street. I went to my credit union, took out a loan, and paid those. It was $1,000 because I will make it better. If you just give me a chance, I will make it better for you, you know. I was looking for love, and I didn't know how to find love. I didn't know the right ways to do it, and I didn't even know that's what I was doing. I just thought I had the means, and why not? You know, I've hitched my wagon to yours, and now we're going this way. Well, I really appreciated the stories that I heard in AA. Here, I love sitting in meetings. You could smoke in meetings back then, you know, and AA meetings are awesome. I mean, there was a lot of, and the dean was sharing this morning about how alcoholics laugh about people that everybody else is like, you know, it's the truth, isn't it? I mean, it's just rowdy. And you didn't have to have alcohol for that fun, you know, so I thought I'd found a new niche, you know. And so we'd been together a little while, and what happened was both of us showed up after a minute, and we were both wounded children inside. And we didn't know how to communicate, and we didn't know how to be in relationship. She had an issue with rage. I mean, she'd been sober like 2 years, and I had an issue saying no. And very quickly, that morphed into, you know, her hitting me and me not hitting back because I didn't hit back when I was growing up. I think God gives me opportunities. Sometimes situations come up in my life as an adult to kind of heal things from way back when, you know. And I learned early on that if I just rolled up in a ball and didn't like fight back, it would be over faster. And of course there'd be the remorse afterwards and all this stuff, and it was very passionate. And you know, it was like high highs and low lows. I mean, it was so dramatic. I was addicted to her. She could walk through the door, and I'm not kidding you, my palms would start sweating, you know. I mean, it was like a visceral reaction that I would have in a good way. In the beginning it was like a good, you know, after a while it wasn't. But ultimately what happened over a course of like It seems like I was with her for like 10 years, and it was probably less than two. That's how much drama was in that time, you know. Kicked out of moving cars. She put her fist through the windshield in my truck. She put her fist through the windshield at home. She broke my eardrum. You know, I remember sitting, this is the denial. I'm sitting in a doctor's office, and he's patching up my eardrum because it was busted. And he said, "What happened to you?" And I said, "I got in a fight." And he said, "You know you can press charges." Never occurred to me to press. I'm like, "No, it's okay. It wasn't that bad, you know." So we had a third roommate, and I wanted to paint this picture for you before I move on. This is what a typical sober night at our house looked like on a Friday night in Burbank, California. I would come home from work. Our other roommate had a penchant for cutting her wrist and not pretending. She probably was making an effort to kill herself, so I would make sure she wasn't bleeding too much before I went to the back room, and we had a free-for-all before we went to the 8 o'clock AA meeting at the Burbank Hospital, you know, because we're going to get some recovery tonight. Well, what I can tell you is that this may be happening in homes of someone even sitting in this room tonight. You know, there may be violence. And what I also can tell you is that you don't have to live that way anymore if you choose not to. I mean, we have solutions. We have a way to live a spiritual life that doesn't involve that, and it's not healthy for you, you know. I was thinking earlier about that because I always try to remember to tell that story because it's true, you know. I mean, we do those kinds of things. Just because we stop drinking and using doesn't mean that the insanity ends in different ways. I don't think that God saves us from drowning in the river just to choke us on the shore. I don't think it works like that, you know, but that's just my opinion. And everything I say here tonight is simply my opinion. It's not the opinion of Al-Anon. So we'd been together a little while, and it was crazy, and I'd been listening to all the stuff you guys were talking about in the AA meetings, and again, that's great for you and not me because I don't have a problem. And I went home. And, you know, going to meetings and not working the steps is like sitting in a garage and thinking you're a car. You're not, okay? You're just not. And so I had been listening to these little bits, but I wasn't doing anything with the information, you know. But I this whole rigorous honesty thing kept coming up. And so I thought, well, maybe, I wonder what would happen if I told my dad I was gay. So I inadvertently, I could not be direct, told my new stepmother, who was the best friend of my dead stepmother. That's a long story, we won't go there. I told my new stepmother, I'm like, wonder what would happen if maybe daddy would find out if maybe I were gay. And then I promptly left to go back to Los Angeles. But by the time I landed in L.A., my father had left me a voicemail. Remember the answer machines you used to have? And it was like probably a five-minute message. And he told me, he said, "You're dead and buried as far as I'm concerned. You don't draw air on the planet. You don't exist to me anymore." He said, "I've called the entire family together and I've told them this." He said, I don't want your name spoken in my presence. And until you turn your life around and do what you know is right, what he knew was right, I can't have anything to do with you." And I was devastated because, remember, I was taught to please him at all cost. And this was happening at the same time I had this feeling, even though I didn't know it was a feeling because I hadn't gotten into program yet. I was suspicious that my partner was having an affair with our mutual best friend because there was some high drama going on with us. And I was asking and no one was telling me. Within like 2 days of my father doing that, I got confirmation that that was accurate information. And I remember sitting on the floor in our apartment in Burbank up against the wall. And I remember thinking, I'm broken. I'm bankrupt. I don't have anything more. Nothing more. And that is my spiritual bottom. That was my Al-Anon bottom, because I knew right then that I was just cracked wide open. It wasn't going to get any worse than this. And I've never contemplated taking my own life, but I knew that if I didn't get some serious help, I could probably do something bad. So that third roommate had been through a treatment center for codependency. We don't like that word in Al-Anon generally, so I say for Al-Anonism. And so she, because it's an ism for sure, man. I mean, we do this crazy crap and we don't even have to drink to do it, you know? I mean, AA's, at least they're medicating, you know? They have a. I remember one time she and I got in a fight and she didn't want me to go back to work. I came home for lunch, and I just worked like a mile and a half away, and she didn't want me to go back. And she put her fist through the window. And so I had to take her to the emergency room. Well, another time she didn't want me to go back to work, and I went and I got my truck, and I went home. went to work, and I'm standing in my office, my lab there, and I heard this heavy breathing. I turned around, and she had literally run to my work, and she had crazy written all over her face, you know. That's the day that she busted my eardrum, and I mean, those kinds of things were happening all the time. It was like such high drama. I lived in complete adrenaline or utter despair for so long because I didn't understand there was a middle. I only knew the high highs and the low lows. I've got to get into recovery here. So my bottom happened, and they got me in that treatment center, and essentially what happened in 21 days is they pulled all my emotional intestines out, kind of laid them out on the table for me and said, you know, Carrie, that's abuse and that's rape, and you got to put the words to the incidents, Carrie, because see, what's happened is I couldn't put words to it, because if I put words to it, it'd be real. And if it's real, I got to do something about it. And up to that point in my life, there was nothing I could do about it. So that was so intense. And they told me that all my belief system was founded upon lies. And it just blew my mind. I kind of lost it for a little bit. And when it's time to go, they told me that, that I could do outpatient for a little while, but that I had to find a spiritual way to live. It was a 12-base thing, and that I had to find a spiritual way to live. Oh, I got to back up. I went to my girlfriend's sponsor, suggested to her early on that I go to an Al-Anon meeting, and there was an AA meeting up Kittredge over in the valley, and there was an AA meeting upstairs and an Al-Anon meeting downstairs. Meetings were an hour and a half back then, and I had been going to these awesome AA meetings where we're like laughing, drinking, smoking, having, you know, coffee and everything, and telling stories, and everybody's laughing about it. So I go into this room. It's an Al-Anon meeting, and everybody's sitting in their chair, and the chairs are in a circle, and there's Kleenex boxes in the middle, and they're crying and talking about their feelings. I'm like, oh my God, who would want to be here? I would not want to be here. So at the break, I shot up to the AA meeting and told her I didn't want to go, and she said, that's fine. I don't think she wanted me getting any, I don't know if it was conscious, but she probably didn't want me to get well either. So that was my one Al-Anon meeting prior to treatment, and when I got out of treatment, I was a very different human being at that point. And I went back into that meeting with a very different attitude than I had, and I asked someone to sponsor me. They said, I've been listening to the things that were told in AA, you know, 90 meetings, 90 days, get a sponsor, get a service commitment. And so and they said, find someone that you like and who has something that you want and ask them to sponsor. So I found an Al-Anon who had a relationship with a recovering alcoholic, and I asked her to sponsor me because that's what I wanted, was someone who had a relationship with a recovering alcoholic. I wanted to find out how to stay with this alcoholic that I was with. And I tried that, and it almost killed me trying that. I'm grateful that my sponsor worked with me. Thank God for the unconditional love and the fact that we don't tell each other what to do here. We don't give advice. You know, I mean, we advise work steps, do things, take actions in the program, but as far as life issues, we don't give advice. Because I would call my sponsor and I would say, we're fighting. She's like, if you're physically safe, I'll talk to you. If you're not, I'm hanging up, and call me when you are. And she never told me to leave. And I'm certain she was drinking blood, biting the tip of her tongue off, you know, because I needed to leave. But she's told me that my life had to be my choice, and that if it was time for me to leave, that my higher power would let me know. And I would have to make that decision. No one can make it for me. My God and I would have to know. So I started doing the steps with my sponsor, and I could get that my life was unmanageable, but I didn't fully concede to my innermost self that I was powerless over that alcoholic in the beginning. I had to get beat up a little bit more for that to happen. And then I did admit it. And I got to the second step, and that frightened me so bad because I have all these ideas of someone else's God that I'm bringing with you, and that God doesn't love me. And my sponsor told me that my God could be whoever I wanted. And that was my sponsor. She had a sense of peace around. I didn't know what it was, because I couldn't identify serenity if it beat me over the head when I got here. But she had a higher power. I could look, and there was something in her eye that I felt it. I wanted more of it. I didn't know what it was. It was peace. It was serenity. She had a spiritual awakening, you know. And she told me that I could use her God. So for the first many months, I would get on my knees at night and pray, dear Stephanie's God, thank you for this day. And she said it was okay to use her God. And you know what? It works. And I'm so grateful for that tool, because I loan my God out to babies all the time, you know. I mean, you'll get your God, just use mine for now. And if God's not bigger than all your problems, you need to get a new one, so use mine till yours is, you know. Turning my will and my life over to God in the third step. I did it to the best of my ability in the beginning. And you know, it's funny, with some recent life events that have happened to me, I think that, you know, if I really turn my will and my life over to the care of God, my life is no longer my own. I show up to do God's work today. And sometimes that looks dramatically different than I think it should, you know, dramatically. At any rate, I started an inventory with my sponsor. She had all her babies come over. We were doing like a workbook thing, and we did that. And I was very frightened to share with my sponsor some of the things, some of the shame, some of the secrets that I carried. You know, I was afraid that if I told her that she would look at me differently. It's one thing to say it to professionals in the hospital because you're leaving there and you're paying them. You know what I mean? It's another thing when it's someone that you're going to be friends with and walk the journey with. And I did my fifth step with her, and you know what? She never looked at me any differently, and I watched to make sure. You know, she didn't go out of the room running with her hair on fire. She just said, "Yeah, I did things like that too." You know, and I did 6 and 7. And in the course of me working these steps, my partner, I was trying to leave that relationship. Ultimately, she moved out to the San Bernardino area, and I found out pretty quickly that I couldn't, like, leave Burbank and drive to San Bernardino to spend some time fighting and get back and then carry on at work. You know, I mean, just too much. So God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And so I began. I'm so smart. I went to college. I told my sponsor, "I have a plan." She died out laughing. She goes, "Let's hear your plan." Because I went to college, right? And I said, "Well, I've been doing this thing all wrong. I don't know how to date. I don't know how to get to know someone. So I've been, like, having sex and making a marriage out of it. And that's not the right way to do it. I need to date someone and get to know them. And then if I like who they are, then it can proceed from there." And I like the whole 30, 60, 90 thing that AA has going on. So I said, "If I find someone I like, I won't kiss them for 30 days. And if I really dig them, I won't have sex for 90 days. And she said, "Okay, honey, that's great. You do that." And just like that, she said it. Because I didn't think she thought I could. And you know what I found out? Water seeks its own level. I was like this broken person walking around looking for something different. And really all I did was I was just pulling in the same type of people that were where I was. And I would tell them about my plan, and they'd be like, "Gone," you know. So I learned about, like, having coffee with people and talking to them. You don't, like, have sex on the first date, and then it's okay. Because what happens is you do that, and 6 months later, you find out you hate their guts. And if you'd taken a minute way back when, you would have saved yourself a lot of trouble. But that's the Al-Anon that I am. At any rate, So I wound up being in a couple different relationships and working the steps with my sponsor in 6 and 7. You know, steps 6 and 7 don't get much airtime a lot of times, and those to me are the ones that give me the personality change sufficient to recover from what's killing me. That's where I get rewired a little bit, and I think that happens over time. My sponsor and I talk about that a lot today. Did an 8th step, made a list, and went to my sponsor, and she made me take some of the people off the list because I still was distorted in my thinking. And so I was going home, and I wanted to do some amends, and I made amends with my mom, because what happened is when I got into high school and playing ball a lot, even earlier than that, I would go see my mom every 2 weekends, and I think what was happening for me, not only did I feel like she had left me, but I think with the abuse that was happening with my stepmom, it's like I couldn't go up and be vulnerable with my mom and then go home and protect myself emotionally, you know. So I just kind of shut down a little bit, a lot, actually. I was walking around sleepwalking half dead through my life. But so my amends to my mom were to tell her what I had done, and I was sorry that I hadn't been more available for a relationship with her, and to see if she still wanted one and that I would be available for one. And we have a great relationship today. It's a wonderful relationship. I couldn't see yet what my part was in my relationship with my dad, because I was still pretty resentful about that. It took a long time. Made my other amends, and finally I understood that I was judging my father for judging me. And I wound up writing a letter and thanking him for just all the wonderful things he had done in my life, because he was a good dad, you know? I mean, in many ways, he had been a great father. And I wrote the letter, and I read it to my sponsor, and she said, "Okay, you can send it." And I mailed the letter, and the letter came back, returned to sender. That was a hard one to swallow. And my sponsor said, "It doesn't matter. You've done your part. You just keep chopping wood and carrying water, honey. You'll know what to do if you're to send it again or see him again." So a year or so later, my family, because they're so wonderfully dysfunctional still, I found out that he hadn't received the letter, that had happened as a postal error, not him making it come back. And so I sent the letter back. I sent it to him again because I kept it. And I'm not sure if he got the letter or not. I don't know. But fast forward several years, and by that time I had left Southern California, was in a relationship, moved to Boulder, Colorado, was working a program of Al-Anon. My partner had been in Al-Anon and OA, and she stopped working her program. And it's interesting because in Southern California, I attended mostly gay and lesbian meetings because they're everywhere. But in Boulder, they don't have that. They just have like Al-Anon. Well, I was still a little fearful, as you might understand. I mean, my whole father disowned me over this. I was kind of scared to come and open up in places that didn't feel really safe. But what I know is that's really an outside issue. If I'm affected by alcoholism, it just shouldn't matter, you know. And so I went in Boulder. I was going to meetings, and I signed up to chair a speaker meeting one time, or to speak at a speaker meeting, at the meeting that I was calling my home group. And I thought, I'm not changing pronouns. I'm just going to tell my story. And if they get up and leave, then I'll know. And you know what? They embraced me. They just loved me. It didn't matter. And that healed a part of me. I can't even tell you how wonderful it was for me to live in Boulder. You know, I met a man there that I'm certain we would never, ever have been friends. He was like middle-aged, white, conservative, Republican, opposite of me, you know. And he became a very dear friend of mine. And he had a brother that committed suicide when he was younger, and he felt responsible for that. And I can remember he would call me in the middle of the night, and we would talk, and he would be able to cry. And he couldn't cry with a lot of people. And I realized that I created a space for him for that. And when I got ready to move down, I met my partner, long story, moved to Phoenix. I was going to drive my U-Haul down there in a day. And it was a long day, but I was able to do it. And he said, well, why don't we put my motorcycle in the back of the U-Haul and pack your stuff, and I'll go with you. And I'm like, why? And he's like, because I don't want you going alone. You know, God has given me everything that I desired. It just didn't look like I thought it would. He gave me, this man is like my brother. He is like a sibling to me, you know, a close friend. And he actually came down later and helped me build a deck on a house that I bought near the Grand Canyon. And it's just wonderful the ways that we can heal if we just suit up and show up. You know, that first sponsor, one of the things that she did that was so awesome is she taught me right in the beginning. She's like, you got to go to 2 meetings a week. You got to call me every day. We're going to work the steps, and you're going to get a service commitment. I had a literature commitment in the beginning, which is good because I need a job. If I'm afraid, I really need a job. And newcomers, for those of you that are new here, if you're scared, just ask us how you can help. We'll give you a job, and it'll help you feel like you're a part of. And you won't have to worry about standing around looking like you don't have anything to do. So I've always been a part of, you know, I heard early on in AA, they said, and I translated this for myself in Al-Anon, like they said, it's hard to fall off the wagon if you're sitting in the middle of it. So I got in the middle of Al-Anon. Once I finally got here with you, I got in the middle of it. I began working, I continued with all the steps, 10, 11, and 12, and so I forgot how I was, my mind went to Boulder, and I don't know where I was, but so I that relationship split up. The one, I was in meditation one day, and things were troublesome in my relationship because my partner had stopped going to program and I didn't. And all of a sudden, everything was my fault. I don't know if anybody's ever had that happen, but. And I know there's some things my fault, but everything can't possibly be all my fault, even if I am the good guy. So I was in meditation one day, and it came to me that my spiritual welfare, I couldn't compromise my spiritual welfare to stay in the relationship anymore. And I realized that if I honored that, I was probably going to get kicked out of my home and the home that we shared, and it was going to be difficult. But you know what? For the first time, I was more important. I was more important. And I had to leave my home, and I had to walk away from a lot of things. And you know what? I never was without shelter. People in the program took me in. I slept on couches until, you know, I mean, everything. God always has taken care of all my needs, you know. I finally got to the point where I was very content without being in a relationship. It was really okay. I was so good with God. I went to speak at a conference in Reno, Nevada, and I had a moment of magic in a hotel lobby with a recovering alcoholic. And I wound up getting in a relationship with her, and she lives in Phoenix, and that was almost 13 years ago. She's got almost 23 years of recovery. I have 25 years, and I wound up moving down to Phoenix, and she was going to move to Boulder, but when I came to Phoenix to meet her friends, I realized that she had a recovery community there that I didn't have as big a recovery community and the fellowship that she had, and I had been looking for that, and I couldn't ask her to leave what I wanted. So I went to Phoenix, and again, I got right in the middle of the boat. I became a GR for a meeting that I started, and I wound up being a DR, and I was an alternate delegate. And I mean, I've done my share. You know, I've learned here that I need to take my turn, because If the lights hadn't been on and the chairs hadn't been set up when I had to go back and crawl into that Al-Anon meeting and ask for help, I might not have it. So I need to make sure that I'm doing my part so that when somebody as broken as I was comes through that door, that they don't have to be turned away. It's almost time. I'm going to close in a couple of minutes. Oh, a couple things I want to tell you. My dad. Okay, so I'm hiking on the mountain in Phoenix one day, and I realize that maybe I could be a good daughter regardless of what my dad is doing. So I decided I'm going to start sending him cards. And I got down off the mountain, and I was thinking about that, and I thought, I'm committed to doing that, you know. And I turn on the radio, and there's a song by Mike and the Mechanics called In the Living Years, and it's a story about a guy who had a break with his dad, and they didn't get to repair it until his dad died. And then he hears his dad and his newborn's tears. I hadn't heard that song in months, I'm not kidding you. And I turn on the radio, and I heard that song. I'm like, wow, that means I really got to go get that card. Well, I didn't at that moment. The next morning, I'm sitting at work. It's about 9 o'clock, and that song comes on the radio. I put down my pen. I go right away to Walgreens to get the card, okay? Because, I mean, God doesn't have to hit me over the head with a spiritual. I mean, he just doesn't have to kill me with a 2x4 today, you know? I am learning. I'm getting better, you know? My relationships are healthy. There's no violence in my relationships. We don't hit, you know, we don't verbally hit beneath the belt. We argue appropriately, and I'm happy in my relationship today, but... So I began sending cards to my dad on birthdays and holidays and stuff, and I felt good about that because, you know, I'm living this life. I'm doing the 12-step life, trying to be a good human being. I'm sponsoring at least a dozen people all the time. I mean, we're just carting them around doing all kinds of things, you know. And I thought, this is one area that I need to pay some closer attention to. So after a couple years, around my natal birthday, I went to my post office box and I was getting my mail out, and I've been blessed to go around to places like this, and I've made a lot of friends all over the country, so I was getting some birthday cards, and I pulled one card out and I looked at it, and my brain did this really strange thing. It didn't compute the handwriting, and I realized it was my father's handwriting. And I opened it up, and it was a sweet little card, and it says, "Dear Snookum," that's what he called me, and I was like 5 years old, "and happy birthday, I never stopped loving you." And I was a puddle. I went directly to my car, called my sponsor, just bawling, you know. So we began corresponding a little bit. And after a couple years of doing that, I'm hiking again. I think I need to quit hiking. And I got it that maybe I need to not wait until they call me to tell me that he's passed away. Maybe I need to go see him. Whoa, that was like huge, you know. And so I go home and I tell my partner that maybe I need to, thinking that maybe she'd say, "Oh, it's okay." And she's like, "Yeah, you absolutely do." And I'm like, "Dog, that's not what I wanted to hear, you know." But that's a good part about having a partner in recovery. And so 18 years after my father and I had that big falling out, I went to see him. It's been like 2.5 years now. And I sat across from, I remembered this bigger than life, man. I sat across from this little shriveled up old man in a Cracker Barrel, and he didn't have any power over me anymore because you have given me a higher power that I didn't need his validation anymore. And I could look at him and think how much compassion I had, because I think that he probably doesn't have tools to deal with a lot of the stuff that he lived through, you know. And it was wonderful. And we talk about work and football, not the things, we don't mention at all the things that he's uncomfortable with. And I'm okay with that today, because I don't care if our relationship has limits. He's my dad. He's the only dad I'm ever going to have. And he's not going to be here forever, you know. I'm going to tell this quick story, and I promise I'm going to wrap it up with this. Alcoholism is a gift that keeps on giving. If you don't believe it, just stick around for a little while. My partner, her niece, had a daughter, April 16th, 2 months premature. Now, when we got together almost 13 years ago, one of the first conversations we ever had was, "Do you want children?" We both were adamant with the no. "No, we don't." And she said, "But my brother has 2 kids. If anything happens to my brother, I have to take care of his kids." Fine, got that. "Yeah, I can live with your mom, no big deal." So we and her mom live together, and it works out fine, you know. I just didn't think that the whole have to take care of the sibling and the kids thing would be second generation. Her niece had a daughter, and the niece is like extremely Al-Anon. God, she needs help, and she doesn't think she has a problem at all. She's so addicted to baby daddy and just isn't taking care. We've been taking care of this baby since June 12th. Like, I have a baby at our home, you know. I mean, it's like it's ours. And I'm like, "Oh, my God, what is this? 3 hours? You have to feed every 3 hours? That's like all through the night, you know. I mean, and you know what? I'm making a great mom. I thought, thank you. I thought my lot in life was to parent broken souls like me in Al-Anon, because that's what you did for me. You gave me my life back. I could give my whole life, and I couldn't just put a drop in the bucket, I'm sure. And here's something. That's the whole third step thing. If you give it up and life is not your own, this was a doozy. I know he's laughing about this. But and it wasn't even a question. When the situation came down of, like, do we want to take care of this baby, it was like, absolutely. It's not even a question. We have to do it. Oh, my God, I'm on Mars, you know? I mean, seriously, I haven't been around babies. But you know what? God has filled my coffers so much that clearly it's my turn. Because when I was young and having such difficulty in my young life, there were always nurturing women in the community that gave to me. God put those little angels there. And in my mind, the way I have to do the little mental gymnastics, it's just my turn. I get to give back. This one just happens to live with me and have to feed her through the night. So I'm grateful to be here. I'm so thankful that you've participated in my recovery today. And thank you for letting me be here.